Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the revelation in the New York Times of 49 questions Robert Mueller wants to ask President Trump, which has Trump tweeting indignantly that the leak is so disgraceful, even though there is a very real possibility the leak of these questions came from the White House, since they did not come from the special counsel's office. Stephen Harper, a lawyer and professor at Northwestern University who has compiled a comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story at billmoyers.com and at investigaterussia.org, joins us to discuss whether the leak is part of a determined strategy on the part of the White House and the Republicans to shut down the Mueller probe. With Rudolph Giuliani now supposedly negotiating with Robert Mueller to bring the inquiry to a swift end, the suspicion arises that this may be a setup to close it down by claiming Mueller is uncooperative and is dragging out what Trump calls a witch hunt. If indeed the White House leaked these questions, while it may feed the deep state hysteria in the Fox News bubble, it may also backfire with the broader public, who can easily see from the questions which Trump is being asked to answer that Mueller knows a lot more and he is looking at real collusion between Trump's family and his top officials and the Russians. Then on this May Day, we will discuss the growing number of teachers' strikes in red states in which teachers are not just demanding living wages, since from 1996 to 2015, teachers' pay actually fell by $30 per week on a national average, but they are striking on behalf of their students for more investments in schools, pupils, and school supplies. Sylvia Allegretto, the co-chair of the Center for Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley, who has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, joins us to discuss the teacher pay gaps and why teachers are fighting back. Then finally, we'll examine further the erosion of America's middle class, with 63% of Americans one paycheck away from the street and unable to deal with a $500 emergency, while over one-third are running out of food, not being able to afford a place to live or have money to pay for medical treatment. Sarah Jaffe, a Nation Institute fellow and an independent journalist covering labor and economic justice and author of Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt, joins us to discuss how working and middle-class Americans should take a cue from the teachers and mobilize to demand better pay and a fairer country. And joining us now is Stephen Harper, a professor of Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He's the author of several books, including Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster's Story, and he blogs at The Belly of the Beast, and he has a comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story up at billmoyers.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Harper.
Thank you, Ian. Let me add one other thing, too. We just recently, and we're in the process, actually, of moving the timeline to the Committee to Investigate Russia, which you may have noticed, it's Rob Reiner's new site that's collecting a lot of this sort of stuff. With Bill's retirement at the end of the year, we've been looking for a good home for the timeline, and we think we have found it. So,
what's the address for this site?
InvestigateRussia.org.
InvestigateRussia.org. So I think a big contribution was made by the New York Times. It's in today's print edition, where they have 49 questions that appear to come from Robert Mueller to Trump's lawyers. And I think this is a big movement forward, is it not, in terms of the public's understanding of what's going on?
You know, it's an interesting development. Here's the way I look at it. My first reaction is that I think that the New York Times buried the lead, because the important thing to remember about this is that none of these leaks are coming from Mueller's team. So you have to ask yourself, why is somebody on Trump's team leaking this, and why are they doing it now? And when you get to the fifth paragraph of the New York Times article, they finally do acknowledge that their source is someone who provided a document to them that was a list of questions that someone on Trump's legal team wrote down as someone on Mueller's team was reviewing with them the list of questions. So then you ask yourself, okay, what's behind this? And we can talk about that if you want. I think it's important to talk about it, because I think what's behind it is that And I'm not sure it'll work at all, because I think it may actually have the effect that you're describing of educating the public. But I think what's behind it is at least an effort, and you can see it already on some of the right-wing blogs, to portray this as illustrative of a special counsel, Robert Mueller, being sort of beyond his mandate or out of control or any number of other ways that I think you're going to see a continued, it's been ongoing anyway, but a continued effort to undermine the Mueller investigation. But I do think it's useful because it does give you a sense, and it gives the public a sense, of how wide-ranging and, frankly, but at the same time focused, Special Counsel Mueller's team is. And to me, you know, and Mueller's a terrific lawyer, and he has some of the very best lawyers in the country working with him on this stuff. And the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that, like all good lawyers, there's a very high probability that they know the answers to these questions, regardless of what Trump has to say in response. But I think it's an interesting exercise. For those of us who've been following the Trump-Russia timeline for a year and a half in a very detailed way, there's very little that's new. But I think the thread gets lost, and I think this does help to restore the thread.
Well, I think what Trump tweeted out today supports what you were just saying, Stephen, in that Trump says, so disgraceful that the questions concerning the Russia witch hunt were leaked to the media. No question on collusion. Oh, I see. You have made up a phony crime, collusion, that never existed, and an investigation began with illegally leaked classified information. Nice. Apart from the self-pity, it seems to be in line with what you're saying, that this was the motive. But there's also another possible explanation of why this was leaked from, I guess, from Dowd's people. Dowd was the lawyer who quit because he was frustrated with Trump, who wanted to have a face-to-face meeting with Mueller and answer questions. And Dowd thought that Trump would expose himself because he's a catastrophe in terms of thinking he can handle Mueller. So it's equally possible that somebody on the inside, why do you think we're getting all these leaks from the inside of Trump White House? Because people on the inside are disgusted by this person who's the president of the United States. They think the American people should know what they see on a daily basis, that this uncontrolled, incompetent, insane presidency.
Could be, but I think it's equally plausible that this is just part of, as I was describing, an ongoing and orchestrated effort that really has as its target the Mueller investigation, whether it's by firing Rosenstein or the talk about firing Sessions for a while, and I don't know who they said it was the source in the according to the Times was somebody not on Trump's legal team, and I don't know, you know, it's hard to know for sure, but I would not discount the possibility that this is just really something, and you saw it even last night, you know, within a couple of hours. Hugh Hewitt was essentially saying that this proves you got an investigation. You know, he's become a very vocal supporter of Trump. Was saying on Twitter, this is proof that the Mueller investigation needs to be shut down. Once there was a determination of or investigation that failed to reveal facts relating to collusion, that should have been the end of it. Well, of course, the irony of that position is that of the questions that are posed, the second largest group of questions are questions relating directly to the topic of collusion. So it's far from a closed issue, notwithstanding Trump's tweeted lie to the contrary.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Harper, who's a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He is the author of several books, including Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster's Story, and he blogs at The Belly of the Beast and has a comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story up at BillMoyes.com, and it's now at, what was again, the Rob Reiner site?
Yes, the Committee to Investigate Russia, which is investigaterussia.org.
So let's add to what you're saying, because I think you're onto something, Stephen. My sense is that the reason that they brought Giuliani aboard, because Giuliani knows Mueller from working together in the New York prosecutor's office, isn't it likely that what's really going on there, that Giuliani's going to say, I tried to get Mueller to wrap this thing up. We did everything we could. We bent over backwards, but they're resistant. They want to drag this out. This is obviously a witch hunt, and I can only recommend that the president fire Mueller. Do you think it's a setup, in other words?
Yeah, I don't know if he'd go so far as to give that horrible advice, although he might, to fire Mueller. But I think the rest of it is, and in terms of a general sort of laying mattresses, if you will, you know, for the public, so that when some axe falls, whatever that axe may look like, that impairs the Mueller investigation. You know, the easier thing for Trump to do, rather than fire Mueller outright, and this has been my concern for a very long time, would be to simply one of two things: either replace Sessions, in which case his replacement could then take over from Rosenstein, or you fire Rosenstein. And ultimately, either of those events would put someone different in charge of the Mueller investigation and be in a position to really clip Mueller's wings in a way that would prevent future indictments and limit the scope and ultimately, you know, lead the investigation of the resources that it needed to be completed. So my own view is it's all just part of a much larger program. And you could even couple it with, and I think you should couple it with, the obstructionist efforts, if you will, that have been happening with a complicit Republican group in Congress who just recently, you know, they leaked that they had draft impeachment articles for Rod Rosenstein. So, you know, this is all of a piece. It's all the same. It's all part of the same program, I think.
It's hard to believe that these right-wing Republicans, these Tea Party Republicans, don't see the shameful reality that they're co-conspirators in potential treason. And it's amazing to see how the political landscape has shifted. Traditionally, right-wing Republicans were always red baiters and Soviet haters, and now they're all making excuses for Putin. And on the left, people that were normally suspicious of the so-called deep state are now hoping that the deep state comes up with the evidence to put Trump in a orange jumpsuit and march him out of the Oval Office.
But yeah, it's an ironic turn of events, to say the least. And of course, what always gets lost in the shuffle of Trump's brain when he talks about witch hunts and the Democrats out to get him, is that when you run down the roster, you know, some of the people who are persisting in the investigation have been lifelong Republicans. You know, James Comey, Robert Mueller, Rod Rosenstein, Jeff Sessions. I mean, you know, and as you rightly note, the FBI, at least historically and traditionally, has been regarded as a very conservative organization. Obviously, it has a mix of political views, but if you had to guess, you know, if you had to just sort of throw a dart against a wall that included the entire roster of the FBI, you probably had a much better chance of hitting a Republican than a Democrat. So it's ironic, and I think that at the end of the day, you know, the people who call themselves the Freedom Caucus in Congress, along with people like, I guess Devin Nunes is in that group for sure. I don't know if he's in the Freedom Caucus, but he's certainly, history will not be kind to those people. It really will not. But they seem not to care. They just seem not to care.
Well, you know, unfortunately, my understanding is that the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, are not running the best candidate against Nunes. He'd be very beatable. It's almost 50% Latino, that district in the Central Valley of California. And instead of running a local Latino activist community organizer in the spirit of Barack Obama, they're running somebody else. So this may have a lot more to do with the Democrats shooting themselves in the foot than the fact that Nunes is arrogant, which he clearly is.
And yeah, you know, the interesting thing about Nunes too, I was talking Friday evening. I was on Lawrence O'Donnell's show talking about the committee report. You know, which of course that's Nunes' committee concluding that there was no quote unquote no collusion, no evidence of collusion. And I think, you know, everyone has lost track of the fact that, you know, Nunes was on the Trump transition team after the election. And Nunes, by his own admission to a Newsweek reporter in December, late December of 2016, said that he was in daily and sometimes more frequently than once a day contact with Mike Flynn. And we all know now what Mike Flynn was doing at the end of December. So, you know, I think that the people, you know, you take a step back and look at the longer scope of Nuna's involvement in this thing. And it's, and then of course we don't even need to, you need to remind people of all the antics of the midnight run with the so-called documents that were going to prove Trump right about Obama wiretapping and all that nonsense. And you know, you gotta, if you're looking at Nuna's, you know, you look at a little bit of context, and it's an ugly picture.
Well, but the guy that Nunez met on the midnight run to the White House was a guy called Ezra Cohen Watnick, who was on Flynn's National Security Council, brought aboard by Flynn. He was given the important role of head of intelligence. Trump recently personally forced the appointment of Ezra Cohen Watnick, who was fired, of course, from the National Security Council, when the new National Security Advisor came aboard after Flynn, who's now subsequently quit or been fired, and now we have Bolton. But Ezra Cohen Watnick, his appointment was forced on the DOJ by Trump himself, and now he is in the National Security Division of the Department of Justice. And I can guarantee you, Stephen, that his job there is to scuttle the Mueller investigation. And I think they've already shown the model of how they do it, this administration, with Mick Mulvaney. They moved him, well, he's moonlighting as the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. His position there is not legally sound, yet he's destroying the Bureau. So there you have it.
Yeah, there was. I'm not sure about whether. You know, I think there's a question about whether Cohen Watnick himself was actually the one. I think it was somebody. I think it was a different individual. Michael Ellis, I think, is the name, who actually supposedly provided the documents to White House documents to Mueller. But it's clear that Ezra Cohen Watnick was involved, at least in assembling documents, and was involved in a project that related to all that. And you're right. I mean, one of the fears I've had, think about the fact that Scott Pruitt is still somehow survived all this, and then ask yourself if what isn't going on here, at least potentially, is holding him in reserve for the inevitable sort of squeezing out of Jeff Sessions, however that occurs, and then an interim appointment that puts Scott Pruitt in, who, of course, will do Trump's bidding to no end, and probably with delight when it came to clipping Special Counsel Mueller's wings on the investigation.
Well, there's a piece in the New York Times today by Michelle Goldberg who describes this situation as truth versus power. And she posits that power is winning. In other words, Trump's winning in terms of shutting this thing down. But, of course, I think that she wrote that column before the New York Times broke this story. So in that framework of truth versus power, what do you think, Stephen, is the important stuff in these 49 questions that the special counsel had drafted to ask Trump? And I believe this was done in March, only, a month ago,
a little over a month ago,
and it was done, it was about the time that Trump's lawyer, John Dowd, quit.
Right. Well, as I mentioned, I do think there's a very high probability that with respect to all of these questions, Mueller already has either documentary or cooperating witnesses or other witnesses who have given him the answers. And he's up against, if he is up against Trump, he's up against a guy who he knows cannot keep his story straight. I would pull two things out. One on the Russia connections. I would say the central theme there is what did Trump know and when did he know it? And you've got everything from the Trump Tower meeting to the business dealings with Trump Tower in Moscow, to the platform changes, sanctions policy, communications with Flynn, the Ukrainian peace plan, and then even continuing with back-channel efforts after the election that Flynn, we know, was involved in. So that'd be one category. I would call it sort of the Russian connections. I'm always reluctant to call it collusion because I think that's such a misnomer. The right concept is conspiracy. And the specific legal claim would be conspiracy against the United States. On the second theme I would pull away would be on obstruction. And there it's sort of an echoing back to the old, Howard Baker question of witnesses in Watergate. What did the president know and when did he know it? In this case, what did candidate Trump or President-elect Trump know and when did he know it? And if you go through that, if you think about it with those sort of themes in mind, you can really account for just about every single question that's asked. You know, why did you do what you did with Flynn? What did you know about what was happening, and why did you do and say what you did with Comey and Sessions? And what about these tweets? I thought that was sort of interesting that they're actually asking about very specific tweets, which to many lawyers, including me, at the time looked like witness intimidation and or tampering, which is a different form of obstruction. So that's the way I would look at it. And then if you take that and look at within those two broad categories, you wind up with, you know, those two broad themes, you wind up with four categories. You get questions relating to Flynn, which there are five. You get questions relating to Comey, of which there are 18. You get questions relating to Sessions, of which there are 8. And then you get questions relating to Russia collusion, conspiracy, whatever you want to call it, communications, of which there are, as I say, the second largest group of questions, 13. So anyone who tells you that, including Trump, that the book on collusion, the Mueller book on collusion, is closed, is they're wrong. It's these questions prove that they are absolutely incorrect about that.
Well, it's obviously open because clearly about Manafort and his connections, we know that his right hand guy, his deputy in Ukraine, was a GRU colonel in active communication with the Russian military intelligence. There are questions about him in terms of collusion. I mean, it's extraordinary that, you know, both Michael Cohen, who was also, they talk about the so-called peace plan, that was another thing cooked up by a pro-Russian Ukrainian lawmaker. Both Manafort and Cohen, of course, are married to Ukrainian women, and they have very deep ties to Yanukovych, Putin's puppet, who was driven out of the country by people power.
Correct. And you know, I've thought since the moment that he pled out that Rick Gates was going to be far more important as a witness who provided continuity. Because, you know, the thing to remember about Rick Gates is that even after Manafort left the campaign, Rick Gates stayed on. And he stayed on through the transition. And then after the election, he went to work for one of the largest political action, pro-Trump political action organizations in Washington. And Rick Gates is somebody who may be very surprising to people in the narrative that he's able to provide, that links a lot of different things that go far beyond just his business dealings with Manafort. And I think you know, it's a reflection of Flynn's significance that, I don't know if people remember, probably there's no reason why anyone but me should, or people that have been following the story extraordinarily closely, probably unhealthily closely. But, you know, there was a report back in, I think it was in the summer, well, for sure it was in the summer of 2017, where Trump reportedly called Mike Flynn, or had somebody call, communicate from Trump to Mike Flynn that he should, quote-unquote, stay strong. And that sort of echoed back in my mind when I heard that back on Friday the 13th, while Michael Cohen's lawyers were in court arguing about privileged documents, Trump called to, quote-unquote, check in with Michael Cohen. You know, these are not, you know, the outlines of what the narrative looks like for someone who has a consciousness of guilt, as lawyers would say, seems pretty clear, and we don't need to go through all the data points. There's lots of them. You know, the more interesting question is, what is the narrative that fits all these things together that's a narrative of innocence? You know, more than 50 communications between the Trump people and Russians during the campaign and the transition involving a dozen people all the way to the very top of the Trump food chain. What's the narrative of innocence that, you know, and that's just a small slice of it. You know, you can go down and include all the different collapsing defenses. You know, first there were no contacts. Well, it turns out there were more than 50. Then there was no collusion. Well, it turns out Trump Jr. says, oh, if you have dirt, I love it. Well, then it turns out, no, it's just opposition research. Everyone would do it. Well, except, yeah, that's illegal when it's coming from a foreign government. And then it's like, well, they didn't really give us anything. And then it's like, well, it didn't help. And then it's like, and then finally we get to, well, it doesn't matter, he's still won in the Electoral College. So these collapsing defenses, which is another thing that lawyers look at when you look at you know, why things are happening as they're happening, when people are abandoning defenses and trying to come up with new ones.
Sure.
It's also telling.
Well, Stephen Harper, I thank you for joining us, and I appreciate your timeline, and certainly a lot of it's been augmented by the revelations in the New York Times.
Absolutely, yep. Well, thank you very much. I'm always happy to be talking to you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Harper. He's a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He's the author of several books, including Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster Story. He blogs at The Belly of the Beast, and he has a comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story up at BillMoyers.com, and it's also up at InvestigateRussia.org. We're going to take a brief station break, and on this May Day, we'll come back and discuss the growing number of teacher strikes in red states.